There are two extremes to which it's possible to go in one's attitude towards sex. One is to idolize it, and the other is to despise it. Just by way of illustration, take the two Lawrences of English literature. T.E. Lawrence, of Seven Pillars of Wisdom fame, had an almost pathological distaste for physical relationships, and he frequently denigrates the body in his novel. D.H. Lawrence, on the other hand, probably comes nearer to any other 20th century writer to resurrecting the old phallic religion of Baal. And exactly the same polarization of attitudes was characteristic of first century Greek thought. If you were here last week, you'll remember that we said the Greeks generally regarded the body as inferior to the spirit. And that led to sexual license for some. For they argued it doesn't really matter what you do with the body. It's an irrelevance, morally. But the strange thing was that that very same negative attitude towards the body also led in the opposite direction. Because it's but a short step from saying the body is unimportant to saying the body is intrinsically evil. And once you say that, of course, then the way to moral advancement is not to indulge the body, but to deny it altogether. And so we find alongside the most outrageous sexual promiscuity in ancient Greek and Roman society, the virtue of asceticism, loudly applauded. T.E. and D.H. Lawrence both had their representatives. And it seems very likely, judging from what we've just read in 1 Corinthians 7, that this tension between advocates of sexual indulgence on the one hand and sexual abstention on the other, this tension was developing also within the church at Corinth. As we've seen constantly, they were always open to secular ideas and attitudes. Just as some were saying promiscuity can do us no harm because we're spiritual, others were insisting that to be really spiritual, you had to practice celibacy. So Paul is faced with an unenviable task, isn't he? He has to defend Christian chastity against both these extremes. In chapter 6 that we were looking at last week, he deals with the permissive admirers of D.H. Lawrence. Flee immorality, he says. But now in chapter 7, he turns to the misogamists, to the disciples of T.E. Lawrence, and what they were saying. And his approach to the subject is really quite systematic, for he's dealing with questions which the Corinthians themselves had raised in a letter. Clearly they were as confused as anybody about the subject, and they sought his advice. One by one, then, Paul answers their queries and offers practical counsel to different categories of people within the church. So we'll work through the chapter together, trying to understand what the application of it is for us today. You'll see on the bulletin we're going to divide it into three fairly self-contained pieces. First, verses 1 to 9, where Paul considers the question, married or single, a Christian choice. He deals with this general issue of celibacy. Then in verses 10 to 17, divorce, a Christian option, where Paul expounds the New Testament teaching on the important subject of divorce and expands it to embrace certain situations that were developing at Corinth. And then finally, missing out that parenthesis section from verse 25 to the end, the pros and cons of marriage, where the apostle meets head on the important question of how important should getting married be to us? Well, let's look at this first section then in verses 1 to 9, married or single. Now for the matters you wrote about, he says, it's good for a man not to marry, but since there's so much immorality, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. Now that first verse, it is good for a man not to marry, or literally it is beautiful for a man not to touch a woman, he literally says. That's almost certainly a quotation verbatim from this letter they had written. It should have quotation marks around it. Concerning what you wrote about, it's good for a man not to worry, to marry. I'm taking up that issue, he says. This then was the view of these Greek advocates of celibacy. And Paul doesn't contradict it flatly. He points out instead that these ascetic individuals weren't taking seriously enough the power of human sexual drive. The temptation to immorality, he says, is a strong one, Very few people are physically or psychologically capable of the celibate life. So marriage then, at the very least, is a necessary moral prophylactic in society. It's a God-given and lawful arena where human sexuality may find its proper outlet and fulfillment. Now, of course, there are other important facts about marriage, which Paul will teach us about in other parts of his letters, in Ephesians 5, for instance. Companionship and children. But Paul is at pains here to make clear that the sexual side of marriage is an essential part of the institution, because there were those who wanted to deny it in Corinth. So he says in verse 3, the husband should fulfill his marital duty to his wife, and likewise the wife to her husband. It's very likely, you see, that some of the Christian couples at Corinth, who had come under the influence of this negative attitude towards sex, were trying, from pious motivation, to abstain from normal sexual relations. They probably thought that now they were converted, such things were unholy and prejudicial to their spiritual growth. The framework of Greek thinking, you see, that was behind them in their mental background would easily lead them to think that way. But Paul will have none of it. There can be no marriage, he says, without eros. A platonic companionship can't be a real marriage. The view these Greeks were expressing, of course, later actually became enshrined in the specious doctrine of the perpetual virginity of Mary. The idea that there is something more holy to live a life of perpetual virginity rather than to have a normal sexual relationship with one's partner. But Paul says emphatically that is not true. The marital contract, as we saw last week, is essentially a physical union, as a result of which two individuals who used to be sole owners of their own bodies now become a joint stock company in which each has a share in the other's body. And that's exactly what the way he puts it in verse 4. The wife's body doesn't belong to her alone, but also to her husband. In the same way, the husband's body doesn't belong to him alone, but also to his wife. Notice parallelism there between male and female. Conjugal rights, he says, are totally reciprocal. Those who are keen to portray Paul as a kind of misogynist should think hard about this verse. For Paul is shattering conventional Jewish and Greek ideas of marriage here. He's refusing to regard the wife as a chattel belonging to her husband. Oh yes, marriage is a possessive relationship, certainly. But it is mutually so. The woman has precisely the same rights of sexual ownership as the man does, he says. So verse 5, do not deprive each other, except by mutual consent and for a time. And come together again so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. Far from being a source of spiritual strength, then, long-term enforced sexual abstinence with marriage can be a positive source of satanic temptation. And recalls Benjamin Franklin's maxim, where there is marriage without love, there will be also love without marriage. Every marriage counselor is aware of how many marital disruptions have their root in the sexual frustrations of one or other partner. Paul's teaching here then is eminently wise and practical, though the prudish amongst us may find it a little bit blunt. He's saying there's such a thing as a marriage debt. A husband and a wife owe one another the satisfaction of their bodies. And for either to refuse the other, whether as a weapon in a marital dispute, or on the highfalutin grounds of Christian piety, well, that's dangerous in the extreme, he says. Neither party has the right to refuse the other in that way. Now, of course, this isn't to be interpreted as a charter for nymphomania. A couple united in Christian love are not going to claim their marriage debt in a spirit of selfishness, precisely because of this bilateral equality of the relationship. The wife's body belongs to the husband and the husband's body to the wife. So there must be a spirit of mutual consideration for each other. The boorish husband who insists on sexual intercourse when his wife plainly would rather not, on the grounds that he has a right, he's treating his wife as little more than a prostitute on permanent contract. Paul wouldn't support that. There are times when, from loving consideration for the other partner, we will waive our marital rights. Equally, there are other times when, from the same loving consideration, We will resist the reluctance born of tiredness or mood and stir up the necessary hormonal responses to meet the other partner's need. Paul's advice here, you see, is the essence of good marriage guidance counselling. To those of you who says are inclined to be ascetics, all right, if you're going to abstain from sexual intercourse for devotional purposes, then make sure it's by mutual agreement and for a limited period only. For he says, sex matters in marriage. And any super spiritual man or woman who tries to make out that it doesn't is just showing their ignorance of human nature. What's more, he says, since sexual drives are so strong in most of us, the norm for human society is that every man should have his wife and every woman should have her husband. The alternative to that is not spiritual growth, but rampant immorality, he says. And we have to bear that in mind, that general perspective which he sets on this subject right at the beginning of the chapter, when we come to later things he has to say about singleness. However, what he says here doesn't mean that the Corinthian assertion in verse 1 that it is good for a man not to marry is totally false. For as Paul goes on to tell us, while marriage is normal, so for some people is the single state. Verses 6 and 7. I say this as a concession, not as a command. I wish that all men were as I am, but each man has his own gift from God. One has this gift, another has that. There's a slight ambiguity here, depending on what exactly we think Paul is referring to when he speaks of a concession. Is he just speaking about verse 5? In which case he means, I'm not insisting that you are to have times of sexual abstention within marriage, merely saying that you may. But I think it's more likely, in view of the way he goes on, that the whole of verses 2 to 5 is in his mind. I'm not insisting that you marry, merely saying that you may. But either way, the vital point is that this whole issue of whether we're married or single is a legitimate area of Christian choice, says Paul. It's not a matter of commandment, but of permission. God's commands are universal rules, obligatory on us all. We are commanded not to commit immorality. But Paul says we are not commanded to be married or celibate. Both of these courses of action are permitted by God, and it follows that both must be consistent then with Christian morality. To put it another way, he says, celibacy is a type of charisma from God. That's the very word to use, a gift. When we get on to chapter 12 of this book, we shall find Paul talking a lot about charismata. The whole point about gifts is that none of them is universal. It's gifts that make Christians different from one another. All Christians, he says, are to be loving, for love is a universal fruit of the Spirit. But he says not all Christians exercise the gift of prophecy. That's a charisma. It's an individual gift. And he says celibacy belongs to this category of gifts too. And each individual must assess his own call in this respect and not try to elevate his own gift over anybody else's. Once again, that statement, I wish that all men were as I am, can be taken two ways. It could be a strong statement of apostolic direction. I will that all men are as I am, in which case Paul is saying, sexual purity, such as you see in me, is a must for Christian living, but there is more than one way in which that requirement of sexual purity can be met. My gift is singleness, for others it will be marriage. Alternatively, it can be rendered as the NIV has done, as a wish. I would that all men were as I am. I wish that all men were as I am. In which case he's using the same figure of speech as he does in 1 Corinthians 14 when he says, I would that all people spoke in tongues. If Paul meant that literally, then he presumably means here that he wants a church full of celibates. But it's clear that isn't what he means. He's talking in both texts about gifts distributed by God's good pleasure in diversity. All gifts are good. As Moses said of old, would that all the Lord's people were prophets. But in the wisdom of God, that's not so. Each person has his own special gift, and our Christian task is to recognize that gift or calling and obey it. So whichever way you take it, you see, what Paul is saying again and again here is that marriage or celibacy is not a question of Christian ethics. It is a question of Christian vocation, a question of Christian guidance. Now, the obvious issue that arises out of that is, how do I know God's guidance to me on that myself? And that's a big question. The whole subject of discerning God's will for our lives is involved in it. But there are certain general principles which Paul, as a good pastor and counselor, can pass on to us in order to aid us to discern what our gift is. And that's what he goes on to do. One by one, Paul considers each group in the Christian society at Corinth and advises them as to how to assess their calling. He begins in verses 8 and 9 with those who are eligible to marry. Now to the unmarried and the widows, I say, it is good for them to stay unmarried as I am. But if they cannot control themselves, they should marry. For it is better to marry than to burn with passion. Well, here's a classic hair-raising text from the apostle, isn't it? Oh, we say how very derogatory of the institution of marriage, Paul. You speak as if marriage were no better than the lesser of two evils. It's better to marry than burn. You're a misogamist after all, aren't you, Paul? Well, it is a very frank verse, and it does tend to shock one at first reading, I grant. But is it really as crude and as dishonourable as some people make out? See, what Paul is really saying is, both marriage and the single state are permitted for the Christian. And he's saying a major factor in determining which is my calling in life will be, to put it frankly, the intensity of my sexual appetite. See, a single person has got to practice self-control in sexual matters lifelong. Immorality is no alternative. Homosexuality is no alternative. They are ruled out by God's law. Not to practice lifelong chastity in that way is a gift, says Paul. Who can doubt it? And it is not, therefore, everybody's cup of tea. Not everybody can face it. And if a person can't, then it is quite clear that the single state cannot be God's will for them. They haven't got the gift. The most pernicious thing, you see, about those who try to make celibacy a virtue instead of a vocation is that they set people a standard of human conduct which the vast majority of men and women are neither able nor intended to maintain. And all that results from that is hypocrisy and dual standards. As the apostolic age wore on, this interest in asceticism became more and more threatening to the church, and we find the apostles having to take a stronger and stronger line against it, till in 1 Timothy 4 we read Paul saying, the teaching of forbidding marriage is a doctrine of demons, he said. The basic principle then is extremely sensible and practical, and it's not limited to this passage. Both marriage and celibacy are good, both are permitted. But it is as foolish for a man or woman to try to be a celibate when they have not been given the charisma of celibacy as it is for them to try to speak in tongues or prophesy when they haven't been given those gifts. Such attempts only end in shame and disillusionment. So Paul is saying, don't let hyper-spiritual romanticizing about the single state lead you into the intolerable situation of tortured sexual frustration. If God intends you to be unmarried, then he will enable you to be happily unmarried, just as Paul was. If not, then the assumption must be that marriage is the right thing for you. Either way, the choice is yours. So much then for the eligible bachelors and the hopeful widows at Corinth. But what about those who are already married? Those who, under the impact of these advocates of celibacy, were beginning to wonder, well, maybe it's the Christian thing to do, to separate in order to pursue the higher calling of a single life. That's the second group he turns to, and it raises with us our second major area of thought, the question of divorce. Is it a Christian option? Verses 10 to 11. Now to the married, he says, I give this command, not I, but the Lord. A wife must not separate from her husband, but if she does, she must remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband. And a husband must not divorce his wife. Now you will probably be aware that the whole subject of divorce is a tortuous one which Christians are not universally agreed upon. There's a controversy raging right at this very moment in the Anglican Church about whether divorcees should be allowed to remarry in church. And that's stirring up no little heat. As far as these verses are concerned, I think it's important to remember that Paul is addressing a specific situation. That of Christian couples who, for reasons of ascetic piety, were contemplating voluntarily dissolving their marriages. Interestingly, that's got a secular parallel today, you know. I don't know if you've come across Mel Kranzler's book, Creative Divorce. In a sense, I hope you haven't. But he argues in that book, it's a typical piece of post-Freudian self-therapy, you know. And he argues in that book that really there's something far more important than staying married. And that is your own personal development, your own personal growth as an individual. Well, in a sense, that's what these folk were saying. You see, there's something more important than staying married, they said. That's our spiritual growth. Surely there's such a thing as creative divorce in the Christian life. Well, Paul is not trying then to give us an exhaustive treatment of the subject. He is trying to deal with that specific. And that's important because there are those who want to absolutize these verses in such a way as to make divorce impossible under any circumstances. And I'm quite sure in my own conscience that that is a gross overstatement. Quite apart from anything else, it takes no account of the exceptive clause, which according to the Gospel of Matthew, Jesus himself laid down in that piece of instruction, which Paul is quoting. Anyone who divorces his wife, except for marital unfaithfulness, causes her to commit adultery, he said. So there are grounds, according to Jesus, upon which a Christian may, not must, but may, divorce their partner, namely sexual infidelity. But, and this is the point you see Paul is making, there is absolutely no permission anywhere for a Christian to divorce simply because he feels like it or thinks it would do him good spiritually. There is a command, he says, from the very lips of Jesus. That's why he says, not I, but the Lord. Jesus, in his lifetime, in the days of his flesh, spoke on this issue and gave a command which quite specifically prohibits such creative divorces. Now, if you look back in the Gospel of Matthew again, chapter 19, it's clear that Jesus, when he makes that ruling, appeals to the book of Genesis. Those whom God has joined, let no man put asunder, he says. And he makes clear he was consciously overruling the later Mosaic civil legislation in the law of Moses, which permitted divorce much more liberally. So it seems clear to me that divorce is an example of an ethical issue where Christian standards must be higher than those that can be enforced or ought to be attempted to be enforced in the law courts. It's unrealistic to expect those who have no fear of God before their eyes and no spirit of God in their hearts to keep Christian marriage vows. Inevitably, in some cases, and maybe in many cases, holy wedlock will be turned into unholy deadlock. Jesus agreed then that for the hardness of men's hearts, because we're imperfect, the law of God must allow marriage to break on lesser grounds than adultery. But he gave no such permission to his disciples. And Paul reiterates his words here. There can be no easy divorce for a Christian then. Even if separation does occur, he says, that doesn't in and of itself break the marriage bond. The couple are still tied to one another morally and have only the option of remaining alone or being reconciled, he says. Now what does that mean in the 20th century? Well, surely it means this. That Christians, unlike many others today, contract marriage in the expectation and upon the assumption that it will last till death. There can be no mental reservations allowed in that. Oh, well, if it ties me down too much, if I find it too boring, we can always split up. No, Christian couples marry in the mutual understanding of lifelong commitment to one another. And that's why Christian marriage vows are so much more daunting than the things you have to say at the registry office. For richer, for poorer, in sickness or in health. Till death us do part. You don't have to say that in the registry office. You have to say that in a Christian marriage service. Of course things do go wrong in Christian marriages, and it would be naive to suggest they don't. But if they do, there is a moral duty upon that Christian couple to move heaven and earth to put it right. If things get so bad they have to have a separation, well, okay. That in itself is no sin, although it's very regrettable. so long as they contract to no other relationships during that period of separation, and so long as they remain open to the possibility of reconciliation, Paul allows it. But the only situation which the Scripture allows in which a Christian husband or a Christian wife may go to a solicitor and say, I want a divorce, is if that partner, their partner, has found somebody else and has chosen in defiance of God's law to contract a new sexual union with them. To be blunt, you see, like we were saying last week, marriage is not a paper contract. It is a one-flesh union of two bodies. And since marriages are made in bed, they can only be broken in bed, according to the ethic of Jesus. And that principle he expects Christians to express in their marital relationships. And no super-spiritual waffle about the virtue of celibacy can excuse our failure to do so. But at Corinth, there was a further complication, wasn't there? What about the half-and-half case? What about when one partner in a marriage is a Christian and the other is not? Now, surely in that case, that liaison cannot be in God's will. Surely in that case, the Christian should separate, shouldn't they, Paul? No, Paul doesn't agree with that either. Verses 12 and so on. To the rest, I say this. I, not the Lord, if any brother has a wife who is not a believer and she is willing to live with him, he must not divorce her. And if a woman has a husband who is not a believer and he is willing to live with her, she must not divorce him. Now, the first thing to note is that when Paul says, I, not the Lord, he is not implying that what follows is merely his own opinion. Nothing an apostle writes in inspired scripture is mere human opinion. Now, Paul here is merely distinguishing a matter in which the Lord Jesus, in the days of his flesh, had given specific instruction, and another matter upon which he now, as an apostle, inspired by the Spirit, must give an additional ruling. That's the point of that little pair of brackets. What is the ruling that the apostle lays down? It's this, that the Christian, in such a mixed marriage between a Christian and a non-Christian, must not take the initiative in divorce proceedings. It's as simple as that. Why? Well, the reason is instructive, and I believe it's a great comfort to people who find themselves in that kind of situation. Look at verse 14. For the unbelieving husband has been sanctified through his wife, and the unbelieving wife has been sanctified through her believing husband. See, marriage is a holy ordinance. Even when it's enacted between pagans, it's a holy ordinance. It was ordained before the fall of Adam, in the time of man's innocency, as the old prayer book says. Certainly a marriage between a Christian and a non-Christian will be a difficult marriage, a marriage that may break up. Paul recognizes the possibility of that in the next verse. But there is certainly no encouragement here for an unmarried Christian to willfully enter a marriage with a non-Christian. That sort of action would be foolish in the extreme. If you look at the very last verse, he says, of a widow, she is free to marry so long as he must belong to the Lord, he says in verse 39. Where a Christian is free to choose his or her partner, it must be in the Lord. But of course, there are a variety of ways, aren't there, in which a mixed marriage, such as Paul suggests here, could arise. The marriage was made during a period when the Christian was backsliding. They made a bad decision. Perhaps the Christian was converted after marriage. Or perhaps, as was often the case in the ancient world, the Christian has pagan parents who compelled him or her to marry the person of their choice. Now, in such cases, Paul encourages, if at all possible, that the marriage should be made to work. You're not to think, he says, that because your partner is not a Christian, that you are relegated to God's second best. Certainly not. There is a special blessing on such a marriage. Because you are Christ's, he says, there is a sanctifying influence mediated to the whole family through that one flesh marital bond. An influence not just upon your husband or your wife, but also upon your children. Otherwise, he says, your children would be unclean. But as it is, they are holy. Some, of course, find grounds for infant baptism there. But that really is reading far too much into the text, isn't it? If that were the implication, then logically, the non-Christian husband should be baptized too, because he too is sanctified through his wife. But that isn't Paul's intention, is it? No, Paul is simply here countering this attitude that was clearly in some Corinthian minds, that for a Christian to be married to a non-Christian was somehow defiling. Paul says the very opposite is the case. Why, it's even possible that such a marriage can be a means of evangelism. Look on to verse 16, which I prefer in the New English Bible translation. Think of it. As a wife, you may be your husband's salvation. As a husband, you may be your wife's salvation. So he says, if you're part of a non-Christian home, thank God for it. Think of it as a place of witness, not as a place of spiritual compromise. And you're not to seek a way out of such a situation. There's no need. Rather, think of it as an opportunity to mediate the grace of Christ to those for whom otherwise it might be an unknown quantity. Or would you say, what if the initiative to break such a marriage comes from the other side? What if it's the unbeliever who is not prepared to persevere with the marriage? Well, then Paul's ruling is different, isn't it? Verse 15. If the unbeliever leaves, let him do so. A believing man or woman is not bound in such circumstances. Now, this verse is the grounds for the Protestant teaching of divorce by desertion. What it amounts to is this, that the Lord's command to his disciples about marriage cannot be enforced on an unbelieving partner. If the initiative for divorce comes from that side, it is right, he says, that the Christian acquiesces, for nothing is to be gained by trying to keep such a marriage together. Now, it's possible to argue about what precisely Paul means by that word, not bound, in verse 15. Does it mean that the Christian can remarry? My own view is that it does, but there are some Christians who will feel in that situation that they can do nothing more but than accept a legal separation until their former partner wants to remarry, and one must respect them if they come to that decision. Similarly, the question of how broadly one interprets not willing to live with him or her should be taken. Does that mean desertion in the narrowest sense, or does it include physical or mental cruelty? Is it just a refusal to live spatially with one's partner, or does it include a refusal to live in social harmony with one's partner? Well, my own view, again, is that Paul would not insist that a wife whose life was being made a permanent misery by a grossly inconsiderate non-Christian husband should have to go on cohabiting with him indefinitely. But again, opinions may differ on precisely how you read Paul's words there. And conscience must rule. But what is clear is that Paul goes, and what Paul goes on to drive home in the verses that follow, is that conversion doesn't dissolve obligations undertaken before conversion or outside the church. But we haven't got time to go through verses 17 to 24 to see how he applies that principle generally, though it has important consequences in all sorts of areas. But suffice it to say, as far as marriage is concerned, motivations of Christian piety are never grounds for divorce. It is impossible for a Christian, then, to feel led by the Spirit to separate from his or her partner in marriage in order to live a more holy life. Even if that partner's a non-Christian, that is impossible. Holiness rather demands the Christian should remain bound. And even in the case of a mixed marriage, it is preferable to retain the marriage bond, and Paul gives great encouragement to that end. So if you place Paul's teaching here, which is not exhaustive, together with the Lord Jesus' teaching, you find there are only two grounds on which the church may recognize the divorce of a Christian. One is adultery, and the second is desertion by an unbelieving partner. And in neither case is divorce commanded, but in such cases, it is allowed. And it seems to me that in these days, where divorce legislation is probably necessarily being liberalized, for there is no point in having a law which nobody's prepared to keep, you know. In such days as ours, where divorce legislation is necessarily probably being liberalized, it is all the more important that the church recognizes again the distinction between Christian marriage and secular marriage. And that distinction is not merely that the former is done in church and the latter at the registry office. The difference is in the nature of the marital promises involved. A Christian understands marriage as something which cannot be broken without sin. It's highly irresponsible, then, it seems to me, for a church today to marry couples without carefully establishing that they really are Christians. On what possible grounds can we ask people to take Christian marriage vows in church unless they are Christians? For 20th century marriage is quite obviously, till the judge us do part. I mean that in all seriousness, that is the way people enter marriage today. Till the judge us do part. But Christian marriage is till death us do part. And the church needs to insist then again upon this emphatic indissolubility of Christian marriage which the Lord lays down for his disciples. And there are probably few things that will mark out the Christian in contemporary society more than that. Well then, we're getting on, aren't we? In the face of these Corinthian advocates of celibacy, Paul's insisted that married couples don't cease having normal sexual relations. And he's refused them permission to seek divorce on pietistic grounds. And he's made clear to those who are thinking about marriage that they're perfectly free to marry or to remain single, depending on God's gift to them. So for one who's reputed to have such a low view of sex and marriage, Paul seems to be remarkably balanced so far, doesn't he? But we have to deal yet with the most difficult part of the chapter, the pros and cons of marriage, verse 25. Now about virgins, I have no commandment from the law, but I give judgment as one who by the Lord's mercy is trustworthy. So Paul is turning to these folk he calls virgins. Possibly they are the same category as he was talking about in verse 8, the unmarried and the widows, those who are eligible for marriage. Or it may be that he has a slightly different category in mind, that of parents who are contemplating whether they should arrange marriages for their daughters or not. And that was a very common situation in Greek society. Once again, he states that this choice between marriage or celibacy is a matter of Christian guidance, not of ethics. I have no command, he says. I give a judgment. He's not offering us inspired imperatives, but inspired counsel. He's not taking away our power of choice, he's trying to help us in making our choice. His words aren't less inspired for being such, but inevitably they're more equivocal. He wants to show us both sides of the marital fence so that we can make our choice responsibly, with our eyes open, so to speak. And he begins by pointing out that contrary to much of the pressure that must have been upon these Corinthian young people, there is no reason why a Christian must get married. Indeed, he says there are definite advantages in remaining single. Verse 26, because of the present crisis, I think it is good for you to remain as you are. Now, what is this present crisis he's talking about? Well, in all probability, he's referring to a specific historical situation the Corinthians were facing, namely the imminent likelihood of persecution. He's writing in the mid-50s AD, Emperor Nero is on his throne. Persecution begins a few years later, it's true, but no doubt already prophets in the church are forecasting troubles ahead, times of stress. Now, in such disturbed and insecure circumstances, a Christian's attitude towards marriage must be different from what it might be in settled times. A wife or a family can all too easily become the tool of a torturer, as Christians behind the Iron Curtain know. And that indeed could be Paul's fear expressed later on, where he speaks about the Christian husband's interest being divided. In times of peace, the running of a Christian family, the practice of hospitality, the building of a Christian home, in all these things, the husband's duty to his wife and his duty to Christ coincide. If that weren't so, then marriage would be out for a Christian always. But in times of persecution, the very devotion and love that a Christian husband is commanded to have for his wife may place him in a situation of divided loyalty. For the safety of his wife and family may be used as a lever to extract a denial of Christ from him or something like that. Paul is right, isn't he, in thinking that a single man can be stronger in situations like that. So all Paul is saying is that in certain circumstances of crisis, then it sometimes pays to choose to remain single. Let us repeat, he's nowhere saying that celibacy is a more virtuous life. In fact, he categorically denies that in the face of those who are trying to pretend it was. But he does agree that sometimes celibacy is more expedient. And, of course, what he's saying there is still relevant today, isn't it? For though we are not constrained by imminent fear of persecution, at least in this country, in the immediate future, there are other considerations of expediency that might make us make up our minds not to get married. Some missionary situations, for instance, where a single person has a great advantage over a married person. When one thinks of the education of children, or climate and the lack of amenities and so on. When one thinks of a very itinerant ministry. You know, the saddest feature of both John Wesley and George Whitfield's lives was their marriages. It's not commonly known, I think, that Wesley's wife eventually left him after 20 years of unhappy and childless marriage. It's questionable to me whether a man of Wesley's ministry was right to get married in the first place. There are certainly a number of ministers I know who have chosen to remain single because they are convinced, though they had the opportunity to marry, God wanted them to remain single in order to make their ministry more effective. So Paul's point in verse 26 is not difficult to understand. There are situations, difficult days, difficult circumstances, specialized ministries, when it is right to choose to remain single. So he says, don't be in a hurry to change your marital status. There's no big deal here. Paul doesn't want to lay down the law. But singleness has its advantages, and you must think about it. Are you married? Don't seek a divorce. Are you unmarried? Don't look for a wife. But if you do marry, you haven't sinned. And if a virgin marries, she has not sinned. But those who marry will face many troubles in this life, and I want to spare you this. If Paul had left it there, there would be little real objection to his advice. But unfortunately for the preacher, he goes on a bit more. What I mean, brothers, is that the time is short, verse 31, for this world in its present form is passing away. Now you see, what we see here is that Paul is setting this immediate crisis which the Corinthians were facing against a much bigger backdrop, isn't it? Namely, the last times, the end of the world, Christ's return. Such difficult days, such crisis days, he says, are to be expected, for we live in the shadow of the end. And that is what makes these verses difficult. Because, you see, in view of that, we can't interpret Paul's comments here as only applicable to Christians living in unusually difficult circumstances. We have to wrestle with them for ourselves also. For if the time of Christ's return was short, when Paul wrote, it is even shorter now. We live just as much in the last times as he and the Corinthians did, if not more so. So we can't evade his words by saying, well, it only applies to crisis ethics, as it were. Now, his words must be just as applicable for us, because we too are part of a world which in its present form is passing away. So what is he saying to us in a more general sense? Well, the clue is there in verses 29 to 31. From now on, he says, those who have wives should live as if they had none. Those who mourn as if they did not. Those who are happy as if they did not. Those who buy something as if it weren't theirs to keep. Those who use the things of this world as if not engrossed in them. What he's saying, you see, is that the coming of Jesus has changed a Christian's attitude towards all temporal and material things. Now, in the Old Testament days, a man's whole life was tied up with his family and with his prosperity materially. Those were the only blessings anybody knew anything about. When God wanted to bless a man in the Old Testament, that's how he did it, by giving him plenty of wives and plenty of children and plenty of money. But now that Christ has come, a whole new perspective has been opened for us. Now, you see, we see how short-lived material and temporal things are. We're able to look forward to an age in which these things will be no more. That doesn't mean we despise them. Certainly not. They are God's creation and therefore they are good, but they are his first creation. And we've got our eyes fixed now upon his second creation, that new world, that new creation. So these material and temporal things, you see, they can no longer monopolize our interest as they used to. Since Jesus has told us about the coming kingdom of God, our heart's treasure is laid up in heaven and no longer on the earth. That's how it ought to be anywhere, says Paul. And that means a vital change of perspective about all worldly things. Property, career, the loss of our loved ones. Yes, and says Paul, this change of perspective also must change our attitude towards marriage. Because Jesus himself made it clear, in heaven they neither marry nor are given in marriage. Marriage is part of the first creation. It's good, but it will not continue in the new creation. And that being so, you see, the idea of getting married cannot obsess a Christian any more than the idea of getting a mortgage ought to obsess a Christian. And let me repeat, it's not that there's anything intrinsically bad about marriage. Certainly not. It's an ordinance of God. It's to be enjoyed by those who are called to it. But in the light of Christ's return and of eternal issues, it assumes less importance than it did in days when this world was the only one we knew about. That's what Paul's trying to say. What's more, says Paul, whether you're going through a time of direct persecution or not, singleness does have positive advantages for a person who is motivated by such spiritual priorities. An unmarried man is concerned about the Lord's affairs, how he can please the Lord, but a married man is concerned about the affairs of this world, how he can please his wife. Notice Paul says, I would like you to be free from concern. So both single and married states encourage anxiety of a kind, he says. The single man is prone to anxiety about spiritual things. He's concerned, he's worried about the Lord's affairs. You may say a desirable anxiety. But it is possible. Paul is giving a kind of sideswipe there at these super spiritual ascetics whose interest in celibacy was unhealthy and fanatical. But it has to be admitted, the married man too has his anxieties, and he tends to be more naturally anxious about material things, the mortgage, the job, the family. Similarly, he says, with a fair sex, a single girl can easily get a nun complex. Verse 34. An unmarried woman or virgin is concerned about the Lord's affairs. Her aim is to be devoted to the Lord in both body and spirit. A married woman, on the other hand, tends to get a Martha complex. All spiritual aspirations are driven out of her by the humdrum of daily living. Both states have their potential for generating anxiety neurosis, single and married. But it has to be admitted, if you're going to worry, it is easier for a single person to be worried about the right things than for a married person. So Paul says, I'm not saying this to restrict you, but for your own good, so that you may live in a right way, in an undivided, or more literally, an undistracted devotion to the Lord. He's not trying then to tense us all up inside. And if we find as we're reading these verses that we're all getting squeezed up and screwed into a knot about it all, that's the very opposite of what Paul wants. He's writing to try and relieve us of anxiety about this issue. So he says, when you think about getting married, weigh up the cost. Maybe you've got the gift of celibacy. And if you do, it would be a pity not to use it. But if you do use it, you will reap spiritual benefits, the benefits of a single-minded commitment to Christian service, which will be the envy of some other folk who are married. Weigh up then the pros and cons. Don't be hurried into making your decision on this matter by social and cultural pressure.